Hello, I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk. With me today are Austin Bay and Jim Dunnigan. Austin is an author, columnist, blogger, and contributor to StrategyPage.com. Jim is a military analyst, consultant for the U.S. military, and well-known author. On Strategy Talk, we discuss current events with our own unique twist. We report news as history. Jim and Austin, welcome this morning. Things have been kicking up in Honduras. I guess, Jim, the first question I have is, it's been portrayed as a coup, but was it really a coup?
Apparently not. As with most Latin American countries, the president, all the major politicians were members of a very small elite, even more so than the rest of the world. Power, money, and everything else tends to be concentrated in, less than 1% of the population. The president himself, who got booted out, he was, an upstanding member of the upper class. But they have a constitution which they had to fight many years, civil wars, civil disorder, dictators, what have you, in Honduras. They've got this constitution, and they didn't just, send a guy a 9mm resignation notice. They went by the book. And what they tossed him out of office for was basically violating the Constitution. So the Congress told him he couldn't, he couldn't hold a referendum even if it was non-binding because the Constitution said only the Congress could, approve something like that. The Supreme Court, which has the final say on items of law, basically said to the Army, the President is violating the Constitution, and therefore he should be removed. Now, the President has supporters. And so to avoid a civil war, instead of just having the Army arrest him and then try him for treason, they just put him on an airplane and sent him to Costa Rica next door. Now, what's interesting is, the rest of it, everybody else in the Americas said that was a coup. But if it's explained to most people, they say, that doesn't sound like a coup. There's lawyers involved. When there's a coup, is a coup run by lawyers? And I guess some wiseacres would say, it was a coup run by lawyers. But basically, they went by their own laws. So it wasn't a coup in the classical sense, and that is catching up with the rest of Latin America slowly and causing no end of consternation.
Right. It's a wonder it didn't dawn on our State Department.
Oh, it did. It did. There was a fair amount of back and forth in D.C., from what I'm told. But the White House decided it was a coup, so it's a coup.
Yeah. you have anything to say about that, Austin?
Yeah, there's you can see a bunch of this on the information available on the internet. Now, I'm not going to attempt to quote you the direct articles from the Honduran Constitution, but I read them, and of course it was an English translation. They're in the very high articles, 200s, both of them, in talking about that address the issue of the president seeking to extend his term and the way the Supreme Court and legislature's role in a situation like this. As Jim said, it's taken Honduras, and not just Honduras, but let's use Honduras let's praise them for their successes in trying to deal with their oligarchic past, the social structure, rule by elites just changing sides, greater democratization. They spelled out in their articles a lot of issues that they have faced in the past and tried to structure it, and they structured it in a legal structure. Now, I'm going to refer to an article that ran in the op-ed page of the Miami Herald, and let's see, today's date is July the 9th. I'm going to say I read this on June the 30th or July the 1st online. It was by a man by the name of Garvin, who had been one of the Miami Herald's Latin American bureau chiefs in Managua specifically. And he, in his column, He said one of the things that was disturbing him greatly about the coverage of the Honduran situation is the missing 10 days to 2 weeks in U.S. press coverage prior to the action by the military to remove the president, because he followed it, and he said that, of course, he was following at a distance because he now has an editorial job in Miami, but he's following because he's been a bureau chief in Central America. And he said that this discussion had been going on in Tegucigalpa about how to manage this, and that was the background. Now, I will guarantee you that the U.S. Embassy in Tegucigalpa followed this. The question is, was this information that is available to the embassy, because the embassy's job, and here I am, President of the State Department. State Department on the ground, this is their business, and it's not just the State Department components, but they're there at the, and they follow the political intelligence and they follow the current events. Is this passed up to the State Department itself, meaning on up into the higher echelons, including the Secretary of State, and they're passed to the White House? Extrapolating from that column, there seems to be a disconnect between, wait a minute, they were having this earlier discussion about the legality of what President Zelaya was claiming he was going to do about a non-binding referendum to extend his ability to be president, and the responses to it in the legislature and the Supreme Court. This all gets kind of murky, but guess what? These are also, this is also the kind of murkiness of quote-unquote democratic politics, but also structured by a rule of law. So this gets into, you know, Jim's response, which is, was this a coup? It sure doesn't look, once you look at the greater context of it, like the classic Banana Republic coup. And as Jim was saying, it looks to me that there's a lot of backfilling going on, at least in the U.S. State Department and in some of the U.S. national media covering Honduras. Has there been a change at the White House? The last headline I saw was that basically, no, they were calling it a coup d'etat. I would say that this is not a classic coup d'etat at all, and the White House has dug itself potentially dug itself a hole.
Yeah,
I mean, in that sense, they could call the 2004 election, 2000 election a coup, because the our Supreme Court had to intervene to determine who was going to be president.
Well, I think there are some people that think that, Jim.
That's true. Some people think that's a coup. But no, I think in terms of Honduras, I think one thing everybody should understand out there in the audience is, and we've been covering Latin America for 10 years now, and so I've seen personally, you know, the same thing repeating itself again and again and again. There are certain things that almost all Latin American countries have in common. They inherited this from Spain. First is statism. That means the state takes an overwhelming role in everything. I guess Napoleon, even religion was included. They basically dominate the economy. It's a very small club. But statism, which to a greater or lesser extent you find all over the world, but what was worse in Latin America was Latin America, once the Europeans came, they destroyed, you know, the cultures, the civilizations that were before them, Aztecs, what have you, Incas. They did not establish the kind of rule of law that we have in North America. In other words, well, in fact, there are studies which you can find on the internet by South American, you know, economists and social scientists, where they've looked at it themselves. I mean, ever since World War II, they've said, well, why is North America rich and why are we poor? What's the big difference? You know, we both put our pants on the same way. We have natural resources, what have you. And once they started asking these questions, you know, and simply examining what, you know, you take an Argentine or a Chilean or a Honduran and stick him in the United States, 20 years later he's making 10 times what his brother back in the old country is making. What the hell happened? Basically, it was the rule of law and property rights. in Latin America, neither of these are as guaranteed as they are in North America, or throughout Europe for that matter. And this makes an enormous difference. I mean, for a long time people say, well, so what? You must be lazy down there or something like that. Well, no. You need some very specific conditions before an economy thrives. And this has been repeated throughout the world since World War II. Every country where the economy took off like a rocket, you had these same conditions. You had rule of law. That's why Hong Kong, you know, that took off before China did. And China basically learned from Hong Kong that there have to be some rules that everybody has to obey before entrepreneurs are going to go out there and risk everything, you know, to try and, you know, get a business going. You don't have that in Latin America. And so what you end up having is a small number of families, for want of a better term, or clans, you know, dominating, using this status form of government to dominate generation after generation after generation. I mean, you'll find in country after country, not all of them, but in most of them, you'll find the same families tracing their fortunes back hundreds of years. And, you know, it seems that the purpose of the state is not to enhance the welfare of the people, but to enhance the welfare of a handful of families. Now, what happened in Venezuela, what happened in Honduras, what's happening now in Peru and Ecuador is what happens again and again in Latin America. You have a member of this upper class saying something has to be done. We need, as Austin will explain, a Bolivarian revolution. And that never works. And, of course, Austin, you can explain that.
Well, look, I wanted to come in and just briefly make a point there. There are exceptions in Latin America. Now, Chile has been something of an exception. They went in and used Milton Friedman and the Chicago Boys. And, of course, there's a lot of issues with many folks involving a Chilean dictatorship and Allende's assassination and coup d'etat and the right. But Chile worked to impose a rule of law that encouraging the kind of economic development that Jim was speaking about. You have a couple of transition examples, and they're rough transitions. Mexico is something of a hybrid. It is in North America, remember, but it is it was a Spanish colony, and you've got all of the endemic issues that Jim pointed out, the rule of elite statism and the like, afflict Mexico, and yet Mexico's in a process of a long-term systemic change. Take a look. Part of the drug war that we have talked about, the cartel war, is certainly dealing with the quote-unquote systemic corruption, but that's the part and parcel of the statism that you'd see in the worst aspects of Latin America. Brazil is something of a transition. Could argue that Venezuela was until it's, and this would be the second, and Costa Rica has always popped up as an exception. There are many things that make Costa Rica particularly unique, and it's certainly not to dismiss it. It is a successful and safe and a comparatively secure place. But let's go back to Venezuela, and Jim, my segue there was the Bolivarians. Well, that's the term. We know who Simón Bolívar was, the great South American revolutionary leader, and he brings about the idea of a unified, at least Spanish colonies. His myth is invoked by Hugo Chavez, and it's in Chavez's rendering. I commend the fourth edition of A Quick and Dirty Guide to War to you in the audience. I realize that's Jim and my book, and I'm selling it. But there's a long explanatory chapter, which is entitled Cocaine Cowboys, that actually goes into the explanation of how Chavez uses this Bolivarian myth. And his concept is that this is a way of ultimately it's standing up against the Yankees. That's the United States, of course. But it also, what it does is it builds him up as a great leader, and he is the modern 21st century Simón Bolívar, and he uses this. Of course, he's got some allies in Bolivia and Ecuador. He's got allies with the FARC inside Colombia, even though Colombia is remarkably successful. I should have included Colombia as another curious kind of hybrid situation in Latin America. And he's tried to extend his influence, certainly through Nicaragua, with the old Sandinista crowd, and possibly with the Zelaya, I'm mispronouncing it now, Zelaya, in Honduras, the president who was recently removed by the military. And it's what he is using is it's really a classic caudillo or a jefe, Latin American jefe, but he's using the Bolivar myth because it's more powerful ultimately, particularly in South America, than the Castro myth. Castro is a great guy for Chavez to pal around with, but he's also in some ways some damaged goods. He's great to show as an example of a guy who quote-unquote stood up to the Yankees, but he wasn't a successful revolutionary. Chavez says, I'm the next Bolivar. And so if the Bolivarian, my truncated explanation here sounds a little bit vague, hey, it means something different every time Chavez invokes it because it's part of his poetry.
Yeah, but the problem is, which nobody likes to mention, is none of these revolutions has worked. And the economists, you know, sitting in the universities throughout Latin America say, no, you don't need a guy with a, you know, with a nice, you know, gift of gab and sitting on a horse and waving a sword at the Yankees. That's not the problem. The problem is more mundane. It's basically making sure everybody has property rights, that you can get a fair hearing before, you know, a court. And there's things like basic literacy. You know, the illiteracy rate in Latin America is abysmal, and it's a major problem in any economic growth, because if you can't read, you know, how can you participate in any kind of, you know, modern economy? And all they do with these revolutions is drive out the middle class, the people who are entrepreneurs and, you know, can read and write. And that's what happened in Colombia, you know, before they finally turned it around, before Uribe and his crowd came in. Because they said, we're not going to run. We're going to stand and fight and stop it. And, of course, what's interesting in Colombia is a situation where the upper class has undergone over a century of civil war, fighting among themselves as to who will be the top dog. And they ruined the country in the process. Argentina is another example of the Bolivarian, you know, the hero, the Peronist. You know, at the end of World War II, Argentina had one of the highest standards of living, you know, per capita income in the world. It's been steadily downhill ever since, because they keep coming in with this idea of, you know, a strong man, even a democratically elected dictator. It doesn't make any difference. He basically just rearranges the deck chairs on the Titanic and tells everybody, you know, hey, I saved your butts, and nothing changes. They don't understand their problem is economics and law. And right. That's hard to sell as a slogan.
Let me point out something to the listeners. Hernando de Soto's book that dates really from the mid-1980s, and it was widely panned by all the usual suspects, but he was totally right. It was called The Other Path, El Otro Vey in Spanish, and it was a direct shot at the Shining Path in Peru.
The major revolution in Latin America, which the economists were proposing with their other path, was simply to give property rights. And you do that by simply going out and saying, who owns the land? Because in many parts of Latin America, there's no clear title. We take title of property for granted in North America. Whenever you buy a house or a property, there's a closing, lawyers get together, you know, forms are stamped, things are registered, and it's unambiguous who owns what. You don't have that down there. Now, in countries in Latin America or parts of the countries where they have implemented that title that where basically you tell people who've been farming in the same, you know, 40 acres, you know, for the last 300 years or longer, say, here's your title to this property. Then the farmer can go to a bank and say, here's my title. I want to take out an agricultural loan. Now, farmers in North America take for granted. They can go to the bank and say, here, I have about 2,000 acres. I need so many $100,000 to, you know, put the next crop in. No problem. You've got collateral. Here's your money. That changed everything in parts of Latin America because suddenly people had value. They had net worth. They had assets. And once you have assets, you can grow those assets. And most people are, as you see with immigrants in this country, we call the immigrant effect. If somebody gets into Europe, or especially North America, they can start a business. Bang! You know, the rags to riches story is very common. You can get the same thing back in the old country if you simply give them the same tools. Something as simple as title to property.
Hmm. I didn't even realize that was a problem.
Big problem.
Wow. Austin, you have anything to add to that?
Arguably one of the central problems that they face, which is why Fernando de Soto's book was so such a great contribution when it came out in the mid-'80s.
Right. Well, it looks like they're not going to let the president back into Honduras. And at this point, are the Latin American countries going to be able to put enough pressure on them to do something, or are they just going to go ahead and do their thing? They've already announced elections in the fall, correct?
It's going to fade away most likely. From what I've heard, more and more people, you know, in the upper echelons of not just the United States government, but other governments are realizing, you know, that wasn't a coup. And, you know, that president, you know, we're backing is not the sort of guy we'd really want to have dinner with. You know, he's another firebrand maniac, like Chavez. And Chavez makes great, you know, a copy for the media, but he's not the kind of guy you want to try and do business with.
Right.
So I think this thing's going to just quietly, you know, fade away. Silence.
On that, I hope Jim's scenario is right, and I think it's the smart one for the United States. If I was going to bet on it, I'd bet Jim's scenario, but realize there is extensive rhetorical and political pressure out there from Chavez, and you do have the initial response of the U.S. government, which was it was a coup. But if you let time and passions fade, as Jim pointed out, that would be the best.
Yeah. Well, first of all, none of the people who said it was a coup want to admit they made a mistake.
Yeah.
That's the big problem right now. So a lot of high-ranking diplomats and people in the executive branch throughout Latin America have been briefed, and the light bulb has gone on in their head. Said, "Ooh, that wasn't a coup. You know, we're backing the wrong guy here." And you don't want to expend political capital by admitting you made a mistake like that.
Yeah.
And so the only cure for that is just shut up and it'll pass.
Now, Chavez is rattling his sword a little bit, but is that just normal machismo from down there?
No, if he makes a move, then it's a whole different scenario. Venezuela invades Honduras. You can see how that would go.
Yeah.
That's not very popular.
I actually don't think that would go, but it would be an interesting scenario in another show to discuss, and actually we do have discussed some of Chavez's more outlandish potential military adventures. This would be an outlandish military adventure on his part, but a fellow like him with a great deal of ego, you never want to underestimate his capacity for lunacy. I just point out, though, when he threatened Colombia with war and the Colombians moved their forces up to the border, Hugo's desire for conflict dissipated very quickly.
Well, for one thing, his military, he may have a lot of new bright shiny toys, but his military is undertrained, correct?
Jim's been covering that for quite some time. Well, Jim, why don't you
Well, yeah, they basically stopped training. The military is not happy. He's bought a lot of shiny new toys, but he's also changed the way they are organized and are supposed to train and fight, and he's basically ruined it. He's basically tried to turn the army into a sort of quasi-guerrilla organization. That has not been popular with the officers or the rank and file, for that matter. And so basically, he's ruined the military as a military force. But then what do they really need it for? I mean, who's going to bother invading Venezuela? So everybody realizes that, so nobody basically pays much attention to him. But he's ruining the economy as well, which you've explained in a couple of bits in the strategy page. And that has more serious long-term effects, because
right.
Eventually there's going to be an uprising, and he's going to be the target, not the United States.
Well, I think that does it for the coup that wasn't a coup, and we'll talk to you guys next week.
Till then.
Take care, Dan.
Bye.
Bye.